Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today, Anne Seba is talking about Les Parisiennes, the women of Paris in the Second World War.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for giving up a hot afternoon to be here. It's wonderful for me. And I'm just going to, by way of introduction, assume that in an audience like this of great history lovers, I'm not going to give you the military version of events. I'm going to assume you're all very familiar with the basic facts of World War II. For example, that there were three principal men in this story, Hitler and Pétain and de Gaulle. And I'm going to tell you as little about them as I can possibly manage. This is unashamedly a talk and a book about the women's version of events. And what struck me when I started researching was how extraordinary it was that nobody had put together before this myriad patchwork collage, if you like, of numerous women, including milliners, couturiers, dancers, actors, singers, résistantes, collaborators, but above all, ordinary women, housewives, mothers, concierges, and prostitutes. And as I started to try and understand, I hope in the course of an hour you will realize some of the many reasons why their stories haven't been told before, I'm just going to say now that I think the main reason is that female heroism simply did not fit de Gaulle's macho version of what had happened during the war that all French men had resisted. So I'm trying to bust that myth. And I think this photograph here helps to explain one of the key reasons. In 2015, President Hollande, and let's not impugn his pure motives, decided that it was time to remember two of the greatest résistantes, Geneviève de Gaulle, that's the niece of the general, and Germaine Tillon, that it was time for them to be reburied in the Pantheon. Now, the Pantheon is France's secular temple to the great and good, but until 2015, there was only one woman buried there in her own right, Marie Curie. And if I tell you that engraved on the pediment outside the Pantheon are the words, "To the great men of France, a grateful fatherland." So you're beginning, I hope, to get the picture that France was, and indeed probably is, a very paternalistic, macho society, patriarchal, where women couldn't wear trousers until very recently, where women couldn't get jobs without the permission of husbands or fathers, women couldn't have their own bank accounts. Women actually couldn't have the vote until 1946. So here are some women demonstrating in the 20s and 30s. In fact, Léon Blum and his Popular Front government tried very hard to organize that women could have the vote, but his government was considered communist and he didn't last very long in power, and then they were overtaken by events and the war. So I suppose what I'm trying to tell you is that the women I've discovered and the women I'm talking about played a far greater role in society than they were formally allowed. And some of you women in the audience might say, well, that's what we women have always done. We multitask. But I'm going to give you a varied account of what the women did and why after the war so many of them just wanted to get on with their lives, establish normalcy, protect their children. It's more complicated than that. But France was not only a patriarchal society, the other piece of background, because this very definitely is, it's not a women's book. It's not anti-male, as far as I'm concerned. It's mainstream history. It's the history. It just hasn't been told before. But the other piece of background is France's complicated relationship with its Jewish population. Another piece of background and context for you. France was actually the first country to emancipate the Jews from about 1806 onwards, in the wake of Napoleon, various laws were swept away in order to allow Jews to play a greater role in society. So not surprisingly, many Jews from Eastern Europe flocked to France in search of, it was the country of the Enlightenment. They thought they would find their liberté, égalité, fraternité. And by and large, they did. But of course, those of you who know the story of the Dreyfus case, it wasn't always so easy and so smooth. So what this picture shows you, the blue represents the number of Jews in Europe before the war, and the yellow represents those who remained. So obviously, Poland is the most dramatic example where the Jewish population was effectively wiped out. But just take a look at France. Plucky little France didn't really do so badly. The figures are that on the eve of war, the Jewish population had swollen to about 330,000, of whom only, I say advisedly, approximately 76,000 were deported and killed. Now, historians refer to this as the French paradox, because you can do the sums. Obviously, about three quarters of Jews in France remained. But why were those 76,000 deported at a time when the Germans weren't actually ready to deport Jews? They were deported by the actions of a sovereign French government based in Vichy, using French buses, French police, taken to camps on French soil until they were deported, mostly to Auschwitz. So why were so many saved? Because of the actions of good French Catholics, Protestants, Derbyists, a variety. So it's that tension, really, that I was interested in exploring. There's one more piece of background for you before I actually start showing you some of the individual women who I've had the privilege to meet or interview, and that is, why did I write this book? Because it's the story, it's the question I was always asked as I interviewed French women. If they agreed to see me, the first question was really, what right do I have to tell this story? And so I had to explain to them. They would always say to me, c'est très compliqué, as if, because I hadn't lived through the war in any way in England, we weren't occupied, how on earth could I understand their story? So the long version of events that I always gave them is that I've always been interested in French history. I studied this period of French history when I was at university 100 years ago. And my father fought in a tank on D+1. He crossed over into Normandy, the Battle of Caen. And I grew up really in a family of Francophiles. We would have our summer holidays in France. France was always seen as a victim country. So that's the sort of long background. There was a particular moment, though, when I was hooked into this story, and that has to do with my previous book, which was a biography of Wallis Simpson. And if you know one thing about Wallis Simpson, you'll know she liked jewellery, and I had lots of lovely pictures of Cartier jewellery in my book. So on the day of publication, I get a phone call from the CEO of Van Cleef & Arpels, who said to me, but Anne, why haven't you put Van Cleef & Arpels jewellery in your book? You know, the Duchess was a very good customer of ours. And I apologised, and I said, well, it's actually a biography. It's not a book about jewellery. And he said, well, Anne, in wonderful French accent, if you come to Paris and spend a day looking at the workshops of Van Cleef & Arpels, maybe I can change your mind. So what girl wouldn't spend a day in Paris looking around Van Cleef & Arpels? So I went, and I can tell you there weren't any gifts passed under the table, I'm sorry to say. No little packages. But what I came away with was actually much more important. He told me the story of this woman who was born Rachel Van Cleef. She changed her name to the more French-sounding Renée. She married a racing driver, Émile Puissant. So by the time of the war, she was Renée Puissant, good French-sounding name. But the story was that both the Van Cleef and the Arpel families were Jewish, they were cousins, they were intermarried, but constantly trying to assimilate and be more French, and constantly, then as now, in competition with Cartier. So always trying to come up with a more exotic setting or great bigger stones. And on the eve of war in 1938, this woman, called Renée Puissant, was running Van Cleef and Arpel. But by 1940, when the Nazis had occupied, of course, they knew her Jewish background. And so they demanded that the company was Aryanized, handed over to a Christian. So she thought she was being extremely clever. She Aryanized the Paris branch, and she thought that she could take as much stock as she could carry in a suitcase down to Vichy, which was a spa town, a bit like Deauville, where the company already had a boutique. And she thought, well, I'll be fine in Vichy because I know all these government ministers. I know their wives, their mistresses, their daughters, you know, they're customers of mine. So not only will the company flourish, but I'll be protected because they're my friends. Well, she was okay until December 1942, when, as I learnt that day, she threw herself out of the window and committed suicide. And I came back haunted by that story. I was haunted by trying to understand how come jewellery flourishes in a time of war. I'm sure you'll all say, well, it's obvious, they're small stones, portable, that's what you'd take if you're on the run. But that's only part of the story. It was much more complicated because Van Cleef and Arpel gave me all their file cards to look at of their transactions during the war. And it was clear that although German soldiers, German officers were buying little trinkets to send back home, actually the French were buying and selling jewellery, and often big pieces. So what I wanted was to understand how can women in wartime care about the survival of jewellery? How can the couture houses flourish? How can cinema and theatre carry on as normal when, on the other side, what gives these years the epithet Les Années Noires, on the other side, people are starving and being tortured and in hiding and in fear of their life. So, again, it was this tension that made me want to understand more about this whole period. So I'm going to start with 1939, when many of the French, at any rate, what are known as le tout Paris or le gratin, really thought, well, there can't be a war, and if there is a war, France is going to win because we've got faith in our Maginot line. So on the eve of war, you have somebody like this woman, Elsie de Wolfe, who gives the most extraordinary, surrealistic ball going on till dawn with jugglers and white ponies, dancing as if there's no tomorrow. But I just want to point out, for now, her dress. I hope you can see it. It's a dress by Main Bochet, cape by Schiaparelli. But have a look at the butterflies and the embroidery on her dress, because that was very important to what went on. The head of the Chambre syndicale is our hero for the moment, because Hitler wanted to take the whole of the French couture industry, lock, stock and barrel, to Berlin. He had Paris envy. And Lucien Lalong argued with him and said, you can't just take the designers without all the thousands, by some account, 25,000 women, and they were mostly women, in their atelier, who were responsible for the specialist skills, inserting a zip, a button, beading, embroidery, sequins. They all had their skill, and many of them were refugees from Eastern Europe. So by arguing to the Germans, you can't have just the designers, he saved the jobs and the lives of possibly 25,000 people, but he created a rod for his own back because he had to carry on coming up with ideas for the couture industry and fabric so that they could continue in operation. just want to point out this woman, Amy de Sotomayor, the most beautiful woman at the ball, who was wearing an early Christian Dior gown before Dior had his own label. In those days, he worked for Lucien Lalonde. So other things that happened in 1939, the designers again, they quickly got in on the act. France was convinced there was going to be a chemical attack, a gas attack. So everybody had to have their compulsory gas masks. And the designers thought, well, you'd better have an elegant cylindrical bag in lots of different fabrics and colours to match your outfit. So fashionable Parisienne bought lots of these cylindrical bags. In fact, there was no gas attack and not even near one. But as an example of how what Parisienne wore was the last word the world over, these bags were imported into Latin America, where there was no war and no threat of war. And the other thing I just wanted to point out is this woman in her elegant silk stockings, because, of course, they became a scarcity or non-existent other than on the black market once the war got underway. So what's a fashionable woman to do who can't wear trousers and you can't go out with bare legs? That also was simply not acceptable in high society. So you can wear mesh stockings for a while, and then you can get your mesh stockings mended. And after a while, when you can't even get your mesh stockings mended anymore, we'd probably call this a pop-up shop today. Elizabeth Arden invented a terribly expensive type of iodine dye, which she called the silk on your legs without being silk. And if you were lucky and had a friend with a straight hand and a good eye, she could paint a seam up the back. So that's how fashionable women managed. The other thing that happened in 39, a lot of women got married, a lot of women got divorced. And Boucheron told me that they did a flourishing trade in engagement rings, because, of course, if you were worried that your man was going to be killed on the front and you couldn't claim his pension, well, the least you could do was get an engagement ring on your finger, and then you could start to claim some of the pension. This woman here, although she was married before 1939, she was called Odette Fabius. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about her, because she's really emblematic to my story. And she was married at 19 and typically an arranged marriage. She was Jewish, but she came from the haute bourgeoisie juive. Her family had been there for generations. She thought of herself as French and Parisienne. She married an antique dealer called Robert Fabius, who her family rather scathingly described as a shopkeeper. They weren't very happy. But anyway, she wasn't very happy because he was a typical Parisian husband who thought that simply getting married shouldn't be any reason to change his habits of visiting his ladies, his mistresses between 4 and 6. So Odette, as you may imagine, was not terribly happy on the eve of war. They had a child. The child was looked after by a governess. She felt deeply unfulfilled. What could she do to give her life more meaning? So she was actually visiting a psychiatrist on the eve of war to try and understand herself. And I'm happy to tell you that war gave her life more fulfillment. She formally joined the Résistance, went down to Marseille, where she had a passionate love affair with a communist Corsican trade union leader. I know it seems funny, but I'm going to tell you it was tragic and it did not end happily, but I'll come to that in due course. I just want to tell you about this woman, Miriam Sansa, who I think has a deeply exotic beauty. Her family came from Poland. She knew only too well what was in store for her if the Germans won the war. She tried terribly hard to get exit visas, in the first case just for her parents, so 3 of them. She had a fiancé in London who was begging her to come to London and leave and get away. She said, I cannot leave my parents. Her mother was dying of cancer. And in the end, she visited all the consuls who could possibly offer her. You needed an exit visa, an entry visa to the new country, and a transit visa. She managed to get all 3. But then it failed because she couldn't get passage on a ship to Shanghai, where they wanted to go. She commented that all the consuls that she saw demanded either sex or jewellery or both. So there's another reason why jewellery flourishes. She insisted she didn't give any of that.
and on the eve of the last boat sailing they just got out in 1941. And they spent the war in an internment camp in Jamaica. It wasn't a great war, but they survived at any rate. So as I promised you, this is not a talk about military history. I am assuming you know about the Blitzkrieg. They managed to circumvent the Maginot Line. And in June 1940, the Germans occupy Paris. And as they proudly said, without a shot being fired. But I think this photograph tells you so much about how the scenario changed almost overnight. Of course, it doesn't tell you that there was a curfew introduced, which was sort of 10, 11 or 12, depending on how quiescent Paris was. The Germans changed the exchange rate immediately, so goods that were already in short supply became extremely difficult for the French to get hold of. You can see the swastikas that went up instead of the tricolour. I'm sure you've recognised this as the Rue de Rivoli, and the other side, of course, are the Tuileries Gardens, where the French started to grow vegetables. Because the terms of the armistice were such that not only did France have to pay a fortune to the Germans for the privilege of hosting the German occupiers, but much of their fertile agriculture and produce was shipped to Germany as well. So the shortages for the French were intense. What you can see in this photograph, of course, is no private cars, there was no gas, so everyone goes about on bicycles. But when I say everyone, Paris has become a feminized city. Almost 2 million men were taken as prisoner of war, and many of those young men of fighting age left, if they could, to join de Gaulle in England. So all of a sudden, it is the women who have to face on a daily basis the Nazi occupying force, and they have to decide their choice of response. Do I spit in his face? Do I walk out of a cafe? Or do I actually try and make the best of this? Do I decide that probably the Germans will win and see how things go? And to begin with, most Parisiennes were attentistes. Not all, by any means. Just look at these women on a bicycle. Bicycles were the only mode of transport. These resourceful women, when rubber was no longer available, I've seen bicycle tires in resistance museums that are stuffed with straw. I've seen some of them stuffed with cork. I wouldn't like to ride a bicycle in a skirt where the tires are stuffed with corks, but they managed. The other thing I just want to point out is look at her hair tucked up in a turban. They made a virtue of necessity. If there wasn't shampoo or hair colorant, then they might as well hide their hair in what became a terribly fashionable response, a turban. And if you didn't have enough hair to make it big, you could stuff it with old newspaper. Hitler, by the way, only came once to Paris. He declared on that occasion, jeder einmal nach Paris. In other words, every German should have the chance of coming to Paris at least once. He knew that Paris was a jewel. He wanted to capture it intact. He wanted to show the rest of the world that the Aryan race was more than capable of preserving the very best of Paris. So going to Paris was, of course, a plum posting for any of the German soldiers and officers. Well, obviously it's better than being sent to the east, but I think this photograph tells you another reason why coming to Paris was something that many German soldiers wanted. Now, there were many, I've seen something called the Deutsches Wegleiter, which was the pamphlet for ordinary German soldiers telling them how to get around, and the one I've seen listed 20 brothels and 20 sanitation stations nearby. And the German soldier who'd had this copy had managed to tick in pencil all 20 of them. He didn't write a report about them. But I was told that actually there was a specially printed, not published, guide for officers. So these were just photographs put together of the best brothels for the officers, because they were very scared just because they'd won a military victory so easily. Maybe the women had something dastardly in store for them, and I don't just mean mustard. But this guide, which I was told existed, there were probably only about 20 of them ever produced, and I was told if I made an appointment at an erotic bookshop, I could go and see it, but the man had aluminium shutters, it wasn't obvious from the street what it was, and he'd probably lock up the shop once I was in there, so I probably shouldn't go on my own. So I actually inveigled my newly retired husband to come on this little research trip with me, and as you can guess from this photograph, he thought researching with me was rather fun. He asked if he could come again. But it wasn't only the German men who found Paris so wonderful. The German women soldiers also loved the possibility of being there. There were many of them. They were formerly called auxiliaries, but they never had an easy relationship with their Parisian sisters. So when the Parisians wanted to be a bit rude about them, they'd call them grey mice. And when they wanted to be really rude about them, they'd call them officers' mattresses. But as you can see here, the possibilities for buying were wonderful. It was a paradise. And to begin with, this is Montmartre, as I'm sure you know, the German officers who were sent were cultured and cultivated. And many of the Parisian women thought, well, why did our parents tell us that they were such brutes? Far from it. But of course, there were varieties depending on the timing in Paris, and the situation got worse. But the theatre carried on all along, and the Comédie Française continued almost from day one. This woman is a bit of a heroine of mine, Béatrice Bretty, because she resigned from the Comédie Française. She said, how can I possibly carry on in a company that won't accept the work of Jewish playwrights where Jewish actors aren't allowed to perform either? So she left and joined her lover, who was this man, Georges Mandel, the politician who actually Churchill had hoped would come to England instead of the tall, lanky man whose name I'm not meant to be saying, who nobody had heard of. But Mandel couldn't leave because he was Jewish, and he said, if I leave, I'll be accused of desertion or cowardice. So Bretty followed him around, and he was almost immediately sent to various camps, and she looked after his orphan daughter. She took him food, she took him messages. She really was, she behaved in an exemplary way. And one of the saddest letters is when Mandel was in Buchenwald, she begged him to marry her. And he said, I can't possibly marry you because I know the fate that's in store for me and I don't want it for you. And sure enough, he was taken out when he was transferred from one camp to the other and shot. And Bretty went on fighting for his corner after the war. She wrote to de Gaulle when he wanted to lay a wreath on his grave and said, you didn't do anything to support him when you could have done when he was in a camp. How dare you, now it's too late, lay a wreath on his grave. And just because I want to show what choice did women have, I interviewed this woman when she was only 100, as you see here. She's still alive at 103, Gisèle Casadesus. And she said that it was perfectly easy to carry on performing in the Comédie Française as long as you didn't accept a drink afterwards with the Germans. I don't think it was that straightforward. As you see in this photograph, performers, I think, were unfairly picked on after the war for collaborating because their role, they were so highly visible. And I think they had very little choice. That was their job. And to give you an example of how nuanced it was, this woman, Sadie Regal, was a 19-year-old Jewish woman from South Africa who longed to dance with the Ballet Russe. She was accepted by the Ballet Russe, who said, wait in Paris, we'll come and pick you up on our tour. But that was in 1939. War intervened and she was trapped. So she was taken on by a place called the Bal Tabarin. Now, the Bal Tabarin, like many of these nightclubs, was fiercely pro-resistant. They hid resistors in the upstairs rooms. They retrained Sadie as a dancer who they called Florence. She danced with Frédéric and Florence. And in 1943, when the Germans sponsored a trip and they wanted to take her to Berlin to proclaim to the world, look what a benign occupying force we are, she said, look, I really don't want to go. I'll be found out that I'm Jewish. And the Baltabahan said to her, look, you've got to go, because if you don't, not only will your cover be blown, but you'll give away all the people at the Baltabahan. And so she went. And just look, also there's Edith Piaf, who went and who's often accused of collaboration because she went on many of these German-sponsored trips. But Piaf insisted that she used the trips to have photographs taken of her with a German, and the photographs were subsequently cut up and helped to make false identity cards to free a Frenchman. So just to give you an example of how complicated this is. Of course, this woman and her photograph with Hitler is not going to speak well for her after the war. She's a Wagnerian, Germaine Lubin, and when she was picked to sing in Bayreuth for the first time, the French thought this was wonderful to have a French soloist picked to sing Wagner, and this is her. Sorry to cut that off, you're not here to hear Wagner, but I do think it's remarkably evocative, and you begin to understand her side of the argument, which was, as a Wagnerian, her voice matured at a particular time. Of course, she had to carry on doing what she was trained to do, which was to sing. It didn't help that Hitler described her as the finest Isolde he'd ever heard. It didn't help that she had a German lover. It didn't help that she sang with a very young Herbert von Karajan, who you see here when he came to Paris with the Berlin Staatsoper. The Germans thought that opera was really their art form that they had invented. They spent 6.5 million francs on opera tickets alone and performed much more Wagner than Mozart. So she was highly visible. Of course, she was picked up after the war. She spent 3 years in prison. She was sentenced to collaboration horizontale and the new sentence of dégradation nationale, which effectively meant exile. She was stripped of her citizenship, her home was taken from her. Although her sentence was commuted and she came back into Paris, her career was over. She could teach, but she couldn't perform. She was humiliated. And just because, as I'm sure you all know, the war has long shadows, her son committed suicide shortly after she returned. Chanel, completely different story, not Jewish, didn't have to give up her shop, simply decided that she would have a more comfortable war in the Ritz with her very young, handsome German lover. So she didn't behave well. She had every kind of black market delicacy brought to her. And amazingly, after the war, she was not picked up for collaboration horizontale, which she should have been. I think it was Churchill, that wonderful romantic, who decided he wanted to protect her reputation because he'd known her before the war. I think she was extremely lucky. Now, jewellery, which is a bit of a theme. Why did it survive? Because it was very difficult during the war when you had to take in the precise amount of metal if you wanted a new piece made. Actually, if you wanted something in platinum, you had to take in 1.5 times the weight. So where did these women find silver to have these extraordinary evening bags, clutch bags made. Well, I'm talking about a very small percentage of the population. It's Le Tout Paris again. But they were so cross with the humiliation that their husbands had landed on them that many of them decided they'd take in the family silver, the family cutlery. After all, it probably belonged to their in-laws' family in the first place. They would have it melted down and a new evening bag made with compartments for lipstick and powder and cigarettes. And so what they were declaring by using these bags on the street, because before the war, to make up on the street or to smoke on the street was not acceptable in a certain social class. So they were really declaring their independence and their independent-mindedness and their anger with their husbands or menfolk for letting them down in the first place, the military defeat. Now, if you didn't have that much money, what could you do to remain stylish? Because remaining stylish became a form of resistance. It was showing the Germans, I don't care what you do, we can't wear uniform, we're not allowed that, so we can't declare the moral high ground, but we can keep looking smart and chic, because that's our way of saying to you, you can't grind us down into the dust. So when leather was unavailable and shoes were made of cork, many of the women decided to spend their evenings searching for a scrap of fabric to cover their shoes. Now, Lucien Lelong was desperately searching for fabric. Once cotton and wool weren't imported, what on earth could the couture houses use to make fashionable clothes? Well, he really did indulge in economic collaboration. He found that cellulose could be imported from German pine trees and you could make a sort of artificial fibre. We'd call it rayon. They gave it a pretty name. They called it fibrane. And fibrane was perfect for showing clothes on the catwalk the first time. It wasn't so good once you washed it because it shrank in half. But he wasn't worried about that. He needed to find work for the couture houses. This is another of his initiatives. He called it Day of Elegance on a Bicycle, and the designers had to come up with some sort of divided skirt or culotte. You couldn't call it trousers for women to ride their bicycles with. Of course, once rationing got underway, many women didn't have enough coupons for a dress, but at least they could go and buy a little bit of lingerie or underwear that would make them feel better. And then Vichy introduced the compulsory wearing of a yellow star. If you'd registered as Jewish, you had to wear one, and that used up 3 textile coupons. And one of those who was honest enough to register, because some people just didn't and took a gamble and hid, but Irene Nemirovsky, who was born in Russia and who really believed in the French rule of law. France was the country of rationality. She adored French. She identified with France. She spoke French fluently, wrote in French, was educated at the Sorbonne. She even converted to Catholicism because it was the religion of France. She had her children baptized, took them to mass. And nonetheless, she was forced to wear a yellow star. She's a really good example of what I said at the beginning was the French paradox, because she was picked up by French police, taken on French buses to a camp on French soil, Pithiviers. On the other hand, her children were saved. They were saved along with a journal that she gave them that they didn't look at for years. They thought it was a diary. And they were saved by a variety of good French, convents, resistors, a governess. And finally, at the end of the 20th century, they looked at this journal and they discovered that actually it was 2 parts of an unfinished masterpiece, which you've probably read, called Suite Française, and it was published in the 21st century. I'm just showing you a short clip from the film, because I believe we've lost a great writer, but I think her powers of observation were so acute. And what you see in this picture is she understood it was the women who had to decide how do we respond to a German officer. I know they aren't all Matthias Schoenaerts, but many of them were extremely handsome, extremely cultured and cultivated, and they absolutely didn't want to be where they were doing what they had to do. So I think if you read Suite Française, you understand some of that. Irène Némirovsky was picked up in 1942. In her case, it was called Operation Spring Wind, which was a Vichy initiative. It was a decision by Pierre Laval, Marshal Pétain, and the police chief, Bousquet, to give the Germans really more than they asked for. In Paris, it was known as the Rafler, the Roundup Duvel d'Yves, because they took nearly 14,000 Parisian Jews, including 4,000 children, the youngest of whom was 18 months. The Germans hadn't asked for children. They actually didn't know what to do with the children, so they were mostly shipped to Auschwitz and killed. But the Vichy government decided, we don't want to take all the adults and leave these children. They'll become a burden on the state. Better to boost the numbers by giving the Germans the children. So I think that's really the moment of France's shame. That's been the event that has been so difficult to come to terms with. And finally, in 1995, Jacques Chirac did admit French culpability. And there is an annual memorial on July the 16th because they were taken to the highly unsuitable Velodrome d'Hiver. I've interviewed a woman who was taken there and who amazingly escaped jumping off a moving train. I think really after 1942, it was almost impossible to be in Paris without knowing somebody who knew somebody who'd been taken. And so that's really when the women started to get involved in myriad activities of resisting. They weren't necessarily part of a formal resistance group, which is one of the problems, because de Gaulle gave awards to people who had been formally registered, people who had used weapons or guns, who had been in combat. Combattant was a key word. So I've tried to show as many women as possible who actually did use weapons. This gorgeous smiling teenager, Marie-France Geoffroy de Chaume, who cycled around Normandy with explosives strapped to her chest. And I've had the good fortune to meet her daughter, who said to me, I just wish my mother had told me more about it. So that, of course, is another key reason why many of the women weren't recognized, because they wanted normalcy. They wanted to get married. They wanted to have a family and protect the children. Here's another thing that many women did. You may think it's a small act, putting pamphlets underneath doorways, but goodness, if you'd been caught, you'd have been tortured in order to give away the network that you were promoting, and with the hope that you'd find the printing press where these leaflets were being printed. Back to Odette Fabius, the woman I showed you in her wedding dress at the beginning. So she goes down to Marseille and she does formally join a resistance group. And on the day she's due to meet the head of this group, the head of the sailors' union called Pierre Ferry Pisani, she decides she will wear her Lanvin suit, but she'll hedge her bets by having a copy of Karl Marx's Das Kapital under her arm at the same time. So they do fall passionately in love. And of course, the resistance is always short of money. So he says, so will you go? Here's a diamond. I want you to sell it and go to Vichy. And she, of course, knows René Puissant. So she goes to Vichy, and René gives her far more money than the diamond is worth. It's probably the most noble act of her lifetime. And shortly after that, she throws herself out of the window. Odette didn't know that. Odette goes back to Marseille, thrilled with all the money that she's got, but they're betrayed almost immediately. And she and Pierre are taken off to prison camps. He's sent to the salt mines of Magdeburg, which he does survive, but only just. and she is sent to Ravensbrück, which she also survives, but only just. I'm not really going to tell you about Vichy, although it's complicated, the relationship. I just want to show you these posters because they indicate how in Vichy, where the laws were made, the statutes against the Jews, Vichy was undergoing its own social revolution, eschewing liberté, égalité, fraternité, for patrie, travail and famille. In other words, telling all the women to have lots of babies, and if they had men of working age, to send them to Germany. So that was the real collaboration in Vichy. And of course, once the Jews had listed themselves, it was easy for the milice to come and empty their flats, as you see here. By now, the Allies are building their invasion force. Nobody quite knows when or where, but Churchill is preparing the special operations executive women, and 39 women were sent into France because, of course, you couldn't have a young man of fighting age on the streets of Paris. He'd immediately draw attention to himself. So many of the women who volunteered for this were deeply idealistic women who desperately wanted to do something, but they had inadequate training, and many of them were dropped into compromised groups. And I just want to show you this woman, Princess Noor Inayat Khan, because she was a musician. She wrote fairy tales for children, a Parisienne to her core, but she was captured almost immediately and very cruelly killed in Dachau. So come the liberation, and of course women are in on the action, and just look at this woman in her skirt, her slingbacks, her stockings and her hard hat and gun. And the liberation brought joy to many people. You may recognize Robert Maxwell in this photograph. He was part of the Free Czech forces who came back into Paris and had a whirlwind romance with a Parisienne teacher, Elisabeth Ménard, and he managed to source her wedding dress from parachute silk, as only Robert Maxwell could. Because I'm telling you the unsung heroines, I'm not denying that there were also collaborators. That's not really part of this talk, but of course it existed. There were, by some accounts, 200,000 Franco-German babies. You know, that's quite a lot of collaboration horizontale. But I do think many of these women were romantically involved. I think many of them did it in order to find a crust of bread for their children. I think very few of them were actually spies, and they were punished unfairly, as you see here, by having their heads shaved and often paraded around town naked or with swastikas tattooed on their foreheads. So as some of the women came back from the camps, Paris had been liberated already for 8 months. Parisians had had a chance to get used to the wonderful feeling of Paris. They weren't very interested in the women coming back from the camps, many of whom described their return as like a second death. So that's another reason why it wasn't talked about. This woman, Denise Dufournier, was in Ravensbrück. She wrote probably one of the first accounts of Ravensbrück. Then she married an Englishman, and I've got to know her daughter too. And she said to me, all my mother wanted really was normality, to have children. This woman, Rose Vallon, a curator when women weren't allowed to be paid curators at the Louvre and then the Jeux de Paume. And she documented all the Nazi looted art. If you've seen the Monuments Men, she's played by Kate Blanchett, who heroically tries to seduce George Clooney. It is actually pretty heroic, because I think the reason that she wasn't recognized is because she was a well-known lesbian, and her story of female heroism absolutely did not fit de Gaulle's picture. But she's an extraordinary woman, and I'm thrilled to bring her again to public recognition. Some women gave evidence. This woman is an actress, Corinne Lucher. The actresses and dancers were picked up almost immediately. You know, if you have someone like Arletty, who everybody loved, at her trial, she commented, oh, well, my heart is French, it's just that my arse is international. So, you know, everybody thought that was very funny and wanted to forgive her, and her sentence was commuted. Not so Corinne Luchaire. This is Geneviève de Gaulle, who I started the story with, giving evidence. The fashion, of course, Christian Dior immediately started the new look because it was terribly important that the couture houses didn't let Italy and America steal their pride of place. I don't think the new look is new at all. It harks back to the Belle Époque, and it's political clothes. These are not clothes for women to go out to work. They fit the argument of de Gaulle's government, where they were telling women, oh, give up your checkbooks, give up being punctual, give the jobs back to the men. They felt that the returning men had been so humiliated that the women should no longer work. So these are very definitely not clothes for working women. They're to please your man. So if Christian Dior was recognised with the new look, why wasn't his sister Catherine Dior recognised? Here she is emerging from Ravensbrück. Her reason was because she was in love with a married man who had children, and she wanted only privacy to live with him. And in conservative, traditional France, what she was actually doing, because he couldn't or wouldn't get a divorce, was living in sin. And she preferred to live with him in sin and not to have her enormous courage and bravery recognised. Again, it's fantastic that she now is being recognised. And of course, not everyone in Paris thought that the new look was great. It was a time of shortages, and many women didn't have enough food, let alone fabric, to make these exotic creations. But the jewellers got in on the act as ever. And here's Cartier showing you that the Parisian woman is finally free because she was able to vote in municipal elections in 1945 and in national elections in 46. So to finish with, here's how women started the war in Paris, looking so elegant, and the last word with their wonderful cylindrical gas mask bags. And here's how they finished the war, building roads in Ravensbrück. Lucky if they had a pair of shoes that didn't have holes in to fight against the freezing cold temperature. And as I pondered, which I often did, of course, what is it that really makes a Parisienne? It's the only city I know of that's given its name to as an adjective for women. Is it simply someone who's extravagant and stylish because she wants to wear the last word and to show the rest of the world she knows what's fashionable? Or is it actually someone who understands why it's necessary and what she's doing? And I was lucky enough to meet the daughter and granddaughter of Odette Fabius, who actually are neighbours of mine in West London. And they told me that Odette, who you see here in Ravensbrück, when she really thought she would die, she was one of the only women to escape. She was brought back and beaten and cruelly tortured. And they told me how when Odette was given, like all the women in Ravensbrück, an ounce of fat to consume per day, she felt it was more important to rub the fat into her hands if she had to build roads. And I felt, understanding her story, that here was a woman who really is a true Parisienne. And as I've thought about all these stories, I also understand why the French found it so necessary after the war to put this period that was difficult and often shameful behind them, and to build up their lives and carry on and hope that the rest of the world would understand and that life, after all, is beautiful.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.